Good morning. Let's all be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today's date is November 6, 2024. We have a total of four matters on today's calendar. The three of them will be heard orally, and I see that the lawyers are here and ready for the first case. So I will ask the marshal to call the first case, please.
Case number A240864, Dalvin Cook respondent versus Gracelyn Trimble et al. Defendants, Coley Grostian appellant.
All right. And counsel, I'll just make a few remarks before we proceed. First of all, I noticed that there are two and lawyers at the table. Are we splitting arguments at all or? Okay, wonderful. That sounds good. And then I'm sure you're familiar with our procedures, but I'll just go over them very quickly. So the podium can be raised or lowered, so please make any adjustments you need. Take a moment to make sure that the microphone is picking up your voice. Today's proceedings are recorded. We of course are streaming live, and so there is an audience that is available and listening to us. But we also record today's proceedings, and that recording is made available on the court's website. So a couple of things with that. Make sure that you identify yourself and the client you represent before you start your argument, and then pay attention to the clock. We really appreciate today's conversation. We look forward to having that conversation with you, but it is a timed one. So pay attention to that. With that, counsel for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court, counsel. Your honors, we're here to, well, first of all, I'm Coley Grosh, and I'm self-represented a litigant in this case. This is an appeal appealing the award of sanctions to me individually by the Honorable Judge Klein out of Hennepin County District Court. This is a dispute over a subpoena for a non-party deponent, an individual named Gracelyn Trimble, who was a former client of mine, who was subpoenaed when she was compelled to appear in Minnesota for a medical examination related to the two lawsuits involving the parties, Ms. Trimble and Mr. Cook. The issue here is that subpoena served upon Ms. Trimble. This court, as you know, has previously ruled on whether that was good service. The record indicates that shortly before, well, first of all, the record indicates Ms. Trimble was in fact served in Minnesota despite serving the U.S. Armed Forces and being stationed in Italy at the time, but she was physically present when she was served. The record further indicates there was a deposition scheduled for December 18th, and shortly before that deposition, in fact, on December 15th, my office sent correspondence to Mr. Cook's attorneys that Ms. Trimble would not be appearing for that deposition. No motion to quash the subpoena was filed in the case. The email, as part of the record, indicates the justification, or at least the belief that she was immune from service due to the fact that she was not a resident of the United States at the time.
So, counsel, if you don't mind, we are familiar with the record in the case, and I listened carefully at the beginning of your comments. You noted that this court, in a special term opinion, had made a ruling on the propriety of the subpoena, and as I recall, actually was in response to an extraordinary writ petition, right? Did you petition for review from that ruling?
I did not, Your Honor.
Okay. And so is that law the case?
I think that matter as to whether Ms. Trimble had to sit for a deposition has been settled, and the proper procedure would have been filing a motion to quash. I don't believe that there's any further appeals on that issue. It's my understanding that ultimately
So how does it relate to today's proceedings then?
it relates to today's proceedings because the fact that the Court of Appeals, this court, didn't agree with not only myself in advocating for Ms. Trimble, but also Ms. Trimble's new counsel in bringing about that appeal. The fact that it was upheld doesn't mean that the basis or advocating for the client wasn't justified. It's our position that the basis that she was immune from service and only compelled to be brought into the court through independent medical examination, that that was an unsettled area of the law, and the advocacy for a client, good faith advocacy for a client, should not be sanctioned and apportioned to the lawyer only.
But even if there is a good faith basis, I think you've acknowledged at least twice now that the proper procedure would have been to bring a motion to quash rather than being a no-show.
Well, Your Honor, benefit of hindsight is 20/20. Certainly, I'd rather not be standing here arguing whether the over $20,000 in sanctions I'm required to pay or not. But at the time, and of course, the conversations between me and Ms. Trimble aren't part of the record. I certainly can't disclose the substance of those conversations, but it was mere advocacy as to Ms. Trimble wasn't going to appear. Here is our position as to why her non-appearance was justified.
But does that communication alone make the subpoena ineffective? By just saying that my client's not showing up, there's still a subpoena out there.
There's still a subpoena. I think the issue is whether the deponent is immune from service or not, whether it warrants a motion to quash. I think the court's ruling on that special session opinion is clear that that is the proper procedure, would be to filing a motion to quash. Ms. Trimble's subsequent counsel did in fact do that, but was denied.
So I guess what I'm struggling with, you referred to the proper procedure. I mean, is there anything in the rules that would suggest that it was appropriate to simply send a letter? I mean, my reading of the rules is that you have to file a motion to quash. It's not a discretionary call, counsel. Am I missing something?
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that. But if the, I guess without knowing what specific precedent you're mentioning.
I'm just talking about the rules of civil procedure, sure. Counsel.
Does the rule require somebody in a foreign jurisdiction to incur the expense of an attorney to answer to a subpoena that wasn't proper to begin with? Oftentimes, motion to quash dispute the proprietary of the information sought. This wasn't the argument in that case, or as far as the legal position we put forth.
The issue wasn't even whether or not she had to appear physically, because this was a remote appearance, correct, by Zoom?
Correct. It was a remote appearance, but she was stationed in Italy at the time. Of course, this court said that, you know, travel was not an issue due to the remote appearance, but there is a substantial time difference between Minnesota and Italy, and she is active duty. But as far as travel and she appearing to via Zoom, that was the nature of the subpoena.
But certainly somebody in the military would understand the importance of following rules, including a court order to appear, though, right?
Your Honor, I don't have any military experience. That seems to make sense to me, but I can't speak for Ms. Trimble.
So, counsel, I understood Judge Reyes's question is not so much about what Ms. Trimble did or didn't do, but your decision, you know, as counsel, because it is, in fact, the district court's call that you weren't substantially justified in either the way in which you proceeded or the merits, right?
I understand that.
Okay. And I guess another maybe more basic question that is raised in the briefing is whether you've entirely forfeited review of this, of the subpoena itself, and whether it was substantially justified or not, because you never filed a motion to quash. Do you understand what I mean by that question?
I do.
Okay. Honor. Would you address that, please?
Well, first of all, I want to address initially this case in Hennepin County appears to have a blanket confidentiality order from the judge, where even in my response in objecting to the motions on February 8th, I was concerned about further sanctions. So by default, I filed it under seal, as is the bulk of the correspondence in the case. My recollection is there was an issue as to whether I was afforded an opportunity to be heard, whether I was on notice of this January 11th hearing to specifically address not only the motion against Ms. Trimble, but against myself. I did not appear. Subsequent to that hearing, Judge Klein, of course, granted Mr. Cook's motions and imposed sanctions jointly and severally on myself and Ms. Trimble. And at that point, I put forth an objection to it, which Judge Klein, of course, took into consideration and reduced the initial amount that counsel was seeking for sanctions.
And you're talking about the January 11th, 2024 hearing?
Correct.
Okay.
Now, keep in mind, this Ms. Trimble is not a party to this. There is no formal correspondence of my representation of it. I'm trying to think back, and unfortunately, due to the confidentiality of the record, despite district courts being a public forum, I'm at a loss as to whether I recall or whether the record supports that I was on notice that this specific motion was going to be heard on January 11th or not. I don't believe it was.
But you were named in the motion, though, right?
Correct.
So if you were named in the motion, you would have received some communication about it then, correct?
I believe I received some mailing correspondence, but there was no, I don't believe there was any hearing set. Don't quote me on that. I don't have that document in front of me.
Okay. Is that in the record anywhere?
Again, I don't know. I'm not privy to the full record due to the nature of Judge Klein's order on this case.
Well, what I mean is in the record that's on appeal before us.
I think I argue it that, at least opposing counsel argues that I didn't show up. But, prior to that hearing, Ms. Trimble had new counsel enter in their representation. I was no longer on the case. So whether the judge, Judge Klein, granted it once it was granted, and the amounts put into an order, then I filed correspondence. So if I wasn't on notice initially, I was certainly on notice after the final order, of which I did respond and object to it.
And you would agree that parties can be jointly and severally held liable jointly and severally, and if that's the case, then each person named is responsible for the entire whole, even if others, for whatever reason, are not held liable. Would you agree with that?
I do agree with that.
Okay.
And on that note, there's an issue where I'm being held responsible for attorney's fees and expenses incurred when Ms. Trimble had new counsel. Respondent cites to a case out of the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, Devaney versus Continental, that indicates whether I was advising my client to ignore this subpoena. There's nothing in the record that I did, but that case involved an attorney of record of a party and continued snubbing of the nose to the court's orders to disclose discovery and continued to refuse to comply, continue to maintain on behalf of the client that non-compliance. This case is far different than that. We have less than a month, a matter of weeks, between the time correspondence was sent that there was going to be seeking some sanctions, and new counsel continued with representation of Ms. Trimble's position. And to have me liable for that amount of attorney's fees and expenses with the appeal and the special session that came here, the appearance on the 11th, the motion to quash subsequent to that hearing, I was no longer on the case. I don't know how my actions as not the attorney of record could be held liable for her continued disobedience to that subpoena.
Well, I think the district court actually took into account what actions had occurred, looked at the particular time frame, even recognizing that you were not of counsel after January of earlier this year. But the district court's order, if I recall correctly, reduced actually the request down from roughly 31,000 to 21,000 and acknowledged that there are certain costs that respondents would have incurred anyway and eliminated those. So it seems like the district court went through carefully to make sure that the request actually was legitimate and was supported by the record.
The district court reduced the request for attorney's fees based on the request for attorney's fees for preparation for Ms. Trimble's deposition, which ultimately Ms. Trimble sat for a deposition. And so they would have had to prepare for the deposition regardless of her initial non-compliance. My argument is different, is once new counsel, as of January 5th, 2024, is on the case, continues down this path of defiance of the subpoena, filing into this court, I have no control over that. I played no part in that. And I think the record, without it being part of the record, a plain look at the record indicates it, my no longer continuing with representation of Ms. Trimble on the continued fight of the subpoena is more consistent with my disagreement with the position rather than the continued fight. And so as far as the basis of my argument that the award should be reduced further, when Mr. Bazans enters his representation on January 5th, I think the district court shouldn't sanction me for his conduct and his further challenge of the subpoena. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And you, of course, will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose. Counsel for respondent, ready for you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Catherine Campbell. With me is Janelle Dresden on behalf of the respondent, Dalvin Cook. We're here today to determine whether the district court acted properly within its broad discretion when it sanctioned Mr. Groshen for his role in his client's disobedience of a lawful subpoena and awarded Mr. Cook approximately $21,000 in attorney's fees and costs in connection with the motion to compel. On appeal, Mr. Groshen is asking this court to ignore the fundamental principle that the district court has broad discretion to issue sanctions against non-parties and their attorneys for discovery violations in favor of arguments that he failed to raise before the district court and are therefore waived on appeal and are otherwise unsupported by both the law and the record. For those reasons, the district court's orders should be affirmed in full. As this court properly noted, Mr. Groshen has waived his right to challenge the district court's decision to issue sanctions on appeal. The only argument that's properly before this court is whether the district court's fee award is reasonable. Despite his statements to the contrary, index number 269 in the record shows that Mr. Groshen was served with the motion papers and that his client was also served with the motion papers. Despite this, Mr. Groshen did not present any opposition to Mr. Cook's motion to compel for sanctions, nor did he present any other evidence in the record to contradict the statements being made by Mr. Cook. I'll further note that Ms.
What about notice of the hearing, counsel?
The affidavit of service shows that he did receive notice of the hearing as well.
Of the January 11th, 2024 hearing?
Yes.
Okay. And what document did you say was that again?
Index number 269, I believe.
Index number?
269.
269, thank you.
I'll further note that Ms. Trimble did respond to the motion to compel, and I think it really begs the question as to why Mr. Groshen claims that he did not receive notice of this motion when his client, who he continued to represent in the related Dakota County action, received notice and responded. It said the only argument that Mr. Groshen ever presented before the district court was with respect to the attorney's fees request, and therefore this court should only consider Mr. Groshen's attorney's fees argument.
So about that, I understand counsel to be saying any fees incurred after January 5th when new counsel filed notice should not have been awarded. What's your response to that?
Well, I think he's misconstruing Rule 37. The relevant inquiry under Rule 37 isn't who was representing Ms. Trimble in connection with the motion to compel, but who was representing Ms. Trimble in with respect to the conduct that necessitated the motion to compel. And there's nothing in the evidence that would demonstrate otherwise that Mr. Goshen was the attorney representing Ms. Trimble at the time that she willfully disobeyed the subpoena.
So, Counsel, would you draw that out for me? So as I hear the argument from appellant, it is that, you know, as of January 5th, he's no longer advising Ms. Trimble. And so to the extent that the fees were incurred to some extent after January 5th, I'm sure they were. I haven't examined the time records in detail, but I bet you have. Then, you know, help me understand how that becomes sufficiently connected to support this sanctions award.
Well, I'll initially note there's nothing in the record that suggests that Mr. Groshen wasn't continuing to represent Ms. Trimble in connection with the motion to compel. He notes that there was never a notice of withdrawal filed, and to the best of our knowledge, he could have very well been representing Ms. Trimble in connection with the motion to compel, despite the fact that new counsel appeared on her behalf. And this is further evidenced by the fact that he was continuing to represent Ms. Trimble in the Dakota County matter.
But that's a separate matter, though.
It's a very closely related matter. And given the overlap between these two cases, I'm hard-pressed to believe that Mr. Groshen wasn't playing a role with respect to Ms. Trimble's opposition to the motion to compel.
What is there in the record to show that he actually was playing a role in this particular matter, though? Because there are several matters. I understand that they're interrelated, but you can have attorneys representing you on multiple related matters. And in fact, that's not uncommon to do that so that you have people addressing particular issues. I mean, was he counsel of record for the January 11, 2024 hearing?
I'll concede he wasn't counsel of record. Okay. He didn't file a notice of appearance in the Hennepin County matter. But again, I think this really misses the point of Rule 37. Because again, under Rule 37, it's the conduct that necessitated the motion, which is what results in the attorney's fees. Whether or not Ms. Trimble was continuing to present these arguments in opposition to the motion to compel doesn't change the fact that because of Mr. Groshen's role in her noncompliance with the subpoena, the motion was necessary in the first place.
But the new counsel sort of doubled down on the action, right? I mean, the new counsel could have come in and said, "Or we see this is out there and she's going to sit for the deposition." And not gone forward with that same strategy. And that's what your opposing counsel is saying. That's a decision they made that he had no part of. So it may have necessitated, the conduct may have just necessitated some sort of response from the court as of the December 15th objection, the letter that came. But when they, on January 5th, when new counsel shows up, they made a strategic decision to continue down that path that he had no part of, and they could have reversed course. So why should the fees then, after they showed up, be attributed to the prior counsel?
I think because the new attorneys continued to take the position that he originally raised in the objection, it would have been, I think, a strategic error for them to go ahead and change the position. And again, I think it just doesn't change the fact that it was his conduct that necessitated the motion to compel in the first place. And that's the standard under Rule 37. It's not who's representing Ms. Trimble in connection with the motion to compel, because those fees, whether Mr. Groshen was representing her with respect to the motion to compel, those fees would have been necessarily incurred anyway. Again, it doesn't matter who was representing her at that time, because Mr. Cook still incurred the fees in responding to the opposition. The district court awarded Mr. Groshen $21,028.34 in attorney's fees and costs for the failed December 18th deposition and the motion to compel. Mr. Groshen challenges the reasonableness of this award, but I'll remind this court that the district court has broad discretion to determine the fee award amount, and it is only overturned if it is clearly erroneous. As this court noted, the district court actually reduced the fee award from $32,000 to $21,000. That is a substantial reduction of over one third. And the court also took into account various factors, such as the attorney's experience, their rates, the work that they completed, and the time they took to complete that work. The motion to compel was brought in with a very quick turnaround because Ms. Trimble failed to appear for her December 18th deposition. Mr. Cook's counsel had to take into account the holidays, and Ms. Trimble's opposition to the motion required Mr. Cook's counsel to engage in some complex legal and factual research. So under those circumstances, the $21,000 is a reasonable attorney's fee award and therefore should be affirmed because it's not clearly erroneous.
I have a question about something that you stated earlier, and maybe I missed it in the briefing or the record. I think you said that the counsel never filed a notice of motion to withdraw in this case. Is that accurate?
To the best of my knowledge, yes.
Okay, so new counsel showed up on January 5th, but at least according to the record, there's no indication that he withdrew from this case.
Correct.
Okay.
And again, I'll note, and I'm sort of beating the dead horse here, but he did continue to represent Ms. Trimble in the Dakota County action through February of 2024.
And counsel, I appreciate the connection between the two actions, but the fee award that were the sanctions and fee award that we're looking at here is in the Hennepin County case.
Correct.
So, yeah, I think from my standpoint, I speak only for myself, it seems significant that there is service of the motion to compel and the request for sanctions, service of the notice, service of the hearing, and as you're relating it, that the counsel did not withdraw in the case. The sanction counsel did not withdraw. I want to go back for a moment to your analysis about why it, quote unquote, is not determinative that there were new counsel essentially, you know, driving the Hennepin County litigation after, you know, some point early in January, right? Because it seems like even though there was no notice of withdrawal, you acknowledge that, correct?
Yes.
All right, and it seemed to me to be clear from the record too. So the district court made a finding in awarding sanctions saying that Attorney Grashin was partially responsible, which I think is in part dictated by the determination of joint and several liability. Is that correct?
Yes, and under Rule 37.
Right, and under Rule, yep, exactly. So, you know, explore that for me, counsel. So partially responsible, was there an analysis by the district court where it considered the responsibility of other actors for the sanctioned conduct? And I guess I'm assuming that would be true of Ms. Trimble, but, you know, perhaps others as well. I don't know.
So Ms. Trimble's opposition doesn't actually refer to any other third parties who were involved in her decision to disobey the subpoena. In fact, I don't think she even acknowledges that she disobeyed the subpoena. I don't think she acknowledges that.
I guess I'm not asking you to comment on Ms. Trimble's responsibility, but on how the district court made this determination of partial responsibility. And I'm just trying to have an understanding of what was in front of the district court.
Yep. Yeah. So the district court based its decision on the totality of the circumstances presented in the record. And the record before the district court are the facts that were submitted by Mr. Cook. And I will reiterate, Mr. Grashin did not file any sort of opposition to Mr. Cook's motion to compel that would have otherwise demonstrated that there were other parties involved in the decision to disobey the subpoena or that he attempted to, you know, encourage his client to obey the subpoena. Instead, the only facts that were presented to the district court were the facts that Ms. Trimble had been in possession of the subpoena for several weeks. During that time period, neither Ms. Trimble nor Mr. Grashin nor any other attorney moved to quash the subpoena or seek relief from the district court. And instead, after the close of business on Friday, December 15th, Mr. Grashin then sends this letter to Mr. Cook's counsel saying, we have a service objection to the subpoena and Ms. Trimble is not going to appear. And then after Mr. Cook's counsel attempted to respond to Mr. Grashin and say, hey, no, that's not correct. This is legally baseless. And also, you never brought a motion to quash. Mr. Grashin never responded. And then there were several unsuccessful attempts to contact Mr. Grashin the morning of the deposition, and he never responded. And then Ms. Trimble failed to appear. And it was based on those facts that the district court concluded that Mr. Groshen was partially responsible for Ms. Trimble's conduct.
Thank you, counsel.
As I mentioned, the only argument that is properly before this court on appeal is the attorney's fee award argument. But I'll briefly touch on the remaining arguments raised by Mr. Groshen because he does spend a substantial amount of time discussing his justification argument. As I mentioned, the district court considered the totality of the circumstances when it concluded that Mr. Groshen had acted without justification when he advised Ms. Tribble to disobey the subpoena. He did not bring a motion to quash as required by the rules. He admits that, and Ms. Trimble ultimately ignored the subpoena. The court didn't just consider the objection that Mr. Groshen had lodged, but also the fact that Mr. Groshen had waited until the evening, until after close of business, the Friday before the deposition was scheduled to proceed on Monday, in finding that he had acted without justification. Now, substantial justification means justified to a degree that would satisfy a reasonable person, or put more plainly, reasonable people would differ as to the appropriateness of the conduct. The conduct here clearly shows, and again, the district court has broad discretion to reach this conclusion, that this conduct would not satisfy a reasonable person. And I'll further note, as you have already stated, this objection that Mr. Groshen lodged was unsupported by the law that as found by this court in its order denying Ms. Trimble's writ of prohibition. In his letter, Mr. Groshen cited to the case In re Coleman in support of his argument that there was improper service on Ms. Trimble while she was in the state of Minnesota. But Coleman didn't stand for the proposition that a subpoena served on Ms. Trimble was while in Minnesota was improper. Instead, Coleman addressed whether a referee abused its discretion in quashing a subpoena that required incurring substantial travel expenses. That wasn't the case here. So at the time that Mr. Groshen made this argument, it was quite frankly legally baseless. And I'll again note that Rule 45 allows service of a subpoena at any place in the state of Minnesota. Mr. Groshen's argument also ignores the fact that the district court considered the totality of the circumstances and not just his legally deficient objection. Mr. Groshen, in effect, is trying to avoid liability by shouldering Ms. Trimble's misconduct solely on Ms. Trimble, who, by stipulation and settlement, is no longer liable for Cook's attorney's fees. I'll direct the court to Aviva Sports and Devaney for the relevant case law on that. And unless the court has any other questions, I conclude my remarks.
Thank you, counsel.
I never filed a notice of appearance in this case. The only involvement in this case that I had for a non-party was sending that email.
Well, counsel, it's a significant email, correct? And you were representing Ms. Trimble when you sent it, right? I assume you're not saying otherwise.
I'm not saying otherwise.
No, okay.
What I'm saying is I never filed a notice of appearance, but Mr. Bezance and co-counsel did on January 5th. So for the argument that I was supposed to file a withdrawal of counsel in a case where I never formally entered my appearance, just pre-hearing notification for a deponent.
So, counsel, as I recall your initial argument, you're the one who stated that you withdrew from representing Ms. Trimble in the Hennepin County case, right? I mean, did I misunderstand your initial argument?
Maybe I misspoke. I was representing her. I'm not denying.
In the Hennepin County case, yes. Yes, that is what you told us in your opening argument.
Communicating to that in that email. And as soon as the correspondence was that they were seeking sanctions and filing a motion to compel, she retained counsel to formally represent her in that proceeding. A little over 2 weeks after the scheduled deposition of December 18th. So I'm not aware of a rule that if I haven't formally entered my appearance in a court proceeding, I'm not denying that I was representing her at the time, Your Honor.
Counsel, what is your response to the argument that on the issue of whether or not you are substantially justified in your actions, that argument is forfeited because you did not raise that to the district court?
I believe without using those exact words, that argument was raised, and that the in the email and the opposition to having Ms. Trimble sit for this deposition was that she wasn't properly served. Yes, she was served in Minnesota, but she was only served in Minnesota because she was compelled by court order to physically be present in this state.
Was that letter addressed to the district court or to opposing counsel?
That was the email that's the subject of dispute in this case. It was just...
So how is that being raised to the... How is that raising the issue before the district court then? For a decision by the district court?
Well, I think it goes to the... whether my conduct necessitated and whether necessitated the motion to compel, and that whether I'm advising the client to deny it, sitting for this deposition or refuse to sit for the deposition, that it was the position when you have a client who takes a position as an attorney and as an advocate, you need to be creative with the law and make legal arguments at the time as to why they shouldn't sit. So the non-compliance and the initial basis and subsequent correspondence, I believe, stands for the fact that my position and my communication at the time, of course, time has changed now, but at the time was, in fact, substantially justified.
But that doesn't answer the question. Let me put the question more directly. Did you ever raise that issue before the district court, and did the district court ever decide that issue that you raised?
I don't believe I specifically raised that issue, no.
Okay.
So, counsel, I'm curious whether you have a response to the arguments of respondents' counsel, noting that you were served with the motion. Excuse me, I've got a little tickle there. The motion to compel and the motion for attorney's fees, and you were given notice of the hearing. You have a response to that?
I have no reason to dispute that, Your Honor.
Okay.
As I indicated, I believe in my initial argument to the court, I know I received some documents. Quite frankly, there's been a lot of documents in this case and a lot of different lawyers involved. But I do want to touch on the fact that Judge Klein found me partially responsible. Seems to me respondent's argument is, if one lawyer puts in motion and argues on behalf of a client to deny proper service of this subpoena, even if they subsequently find that position to be contrary to the law and at odds with their obligation to the court, if another lawyer picks up and continues on however long, I'm responsible for that continued fight.
Partially responsible.
Partially responsible.
Counsel, that's what the district court found. And I think at most what we're being asked is whether there's an error with regard to that determination. I'm not positive that's true, because you didn't contest it, right, below. And so perhaps that's forfeited as well. But just assuming it isn't, that question is in front of the court. I mean, we've got an argument, and you can feel free to respond in your last, you know, few minutes. But we got an argument from respondents' counsel as to how the record supported that determination of partial responsibility.
Well, Your Honor, I'm out of time. I'll just say that if the court doesn't find I properly preserved that issue, at least it's warranted to reduce the award of sanctions against me for conduct I had zero involvement in. The fact that I continued for a short period of time to continue to represent Mr. Trimble for only about another month and a half, in a separate matter, albeit somewhat related, has no bearing on whether I continued to advise or necessitated Mr. Cook's continued attorney's expenses in challenging our position. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Our thanks to both lawyers in this case. We very much appreciate hearing arguments today. They help the court. With that, this matter is now submitted to the court for its determination, and we will issue a written decision within the statutory timeline. Thank you.